Today at Reader's Corner, Amy Goldstein, author of Janesville, An American Story. I'm Bob Custrow. Welcome to Reader's Corner. The Great Recession ultimately left millions of Americans without jobs and devastated entire communities. The bruises have lingered, perhaps nowhere more so than in the industrial communities of our nation's heartland, in places like Janesville, Wisconsin. Janesville was home to the oldest operating General Motors plant until it shut down in the midst of the Great Recession 2 days before Christmas in 2008. Washington Post reporter Amy Goldstein spent years in Janesville piecing together the inside story. Her book, Janesville, is an intimate account of what happened to the town and its people in the years following the devastating loss of GM. The book delves into the lives of auto workers, teachers, politicians, and job retrainers, and it illustrates why it's so hard to create a healthy, prosperous working class. Janesville is now out in paperback. Ms. Goldstein has been a staff writer at the Washington Post for 30 years. She currently covers health care policy, focusing on the 2010 federal law reshaping the U.S. health care system. She was a part of a team of Washington Post reporters awarded the 2002 Pulitzer Prize for national reporting for the newspaper's coverage of 9/11 and the government's response to the attacks. Amy Goldstein, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Good to be with you.
So, Amy, why don't we start here with what happened in Janesville? If you would take us through exactly the nature of this GM plant and how many people lost their jobs, basically the background for what allowed you to call Janesville your second home for a good number of months, if not years.
Well, I was interested in finding a community that could serve as a microcosm or a metaphor for what was happening in lots of places during and after the Great Recession, in which people were losing all kinds of work. And Janesville was a very good place to tell this story. The General Motors plant called the Janesville Assembly Plant there had started out making tractors in 1919, just after the end of World War I, and it had begun making Chevys in 1923. So generations of people considered this the best working-class jobs in town. At its heyday in the 1970s, the plant was employing about 7,000 people. And because the plant existed, there were all kinds of supplier companies nearby that were providing goods and services to the plant. So against this long industrial history, which Janesville and its people were very proud, the Great Recession came along. And in June of 2008, General Motors, that Janesville's plant was going to be one of four that it was going to close down in the next months. And it closed down, as you said, just before Christmas of 2008. During the last two shifts that were there, there were about 3,000 people who had been working there and lost their jobs, and there were a few thousand more people who were working at these suppliers. And then because all those people were out of work, there were all kinds of small businesses in town that just couldn't keep going because they didn't have enough customers anymore. So it was this cascading effect of vanishing jobs.
Now, these workers, did I read correctly that they were making $28 an hour?
That's right. It was a United Auto Workers plant, like a lot of the car industry. And most of the workers there who had a good deal of seniority were making $28 an hour. So when it came time for them to look for other jobs after the plant closed, first of all, there was a lot of denial. People thought that the plant inevitably would get another product to make. I mean, that's what had been happening for close to a century. And it didn't happen this time. So when people went to look for other jobs, there was just nothing around if they could find a job at all that paid anything like that.
Now, didn't GM offer some buyouts? Explain how that works.
Well, there were people who were eligible for retirement, and there were other people who were eligible for buyouts. And what you could get in a buyout evolved over time. But one of the families I follow three main auto worker families, and one of them had a guy who'd been working at General Motors for 17 years, and after a couple years of not having work, he decided to take a buyout. It was just a few thousand dollars, but the real selling point for his family at that point was that it came with six extra months of health insurance. He had a wife and three kids. So it was that little bit of extra health insurance that caused him to decide it was worthwhile forfeiting the chance that he would ever be a GMer again.
So another option for some of these workers is to go to another plant. And there were some, I think, who went off to, what, Fort Wayne in Kansas City? That's call them
right.
Gypsies.
There was a group of people called GM Gypsies, exactly. And these were people who had transfer offers to plants in the General Motors firmament that were still functioning. So there were people who went off to Texas and Kansas City and Michigan and Ohio. And one family I follow has a worker who begins to commute after a few years to Fort Wayne, Indiana, which is about 300 miles away. Every Monday morning, he and a couple of other GM buddies commuted to Indiana. They worked there all week, and they came home late on Friday nights. And the thing that makes them gypsies is that all these people could have moved to where their new work was, and some people did. But for an awful lot of people, Janesville really is home. You think about a plant that was there for so many generations, and to get a job in the plant, you often were handed that opportunity by a relative or a friend. So there were all these extended families in town, and people, for the most part, didn't want to move. So they left their families back in Janesville and have been commuting long, long distances for a number of years now, hoping that they'll get to the magic of 30 years of employment in General Motors, at which point they can retire still with a good pension.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that, because as I was reading the book, I was a little surprised that there wasn't more interest on the part of these families in just picking up and moving instead of these guys driving all night on Friday night to get home for 2 days and getting back into the car on Sunday night to get back on Monday morning. It just sounds like an unbelievable drag. But I suppose that really tells you something about small town America, not just Janesville, but about the attachment that people have to place.
I think that's exactly right. You know, we often have a notion that when jobs disappear from one part of the country, the people who live there should simply pick up and move to where there are more jobs. And it's not so easily done. I mean, people, at least the ones I got to know in Janesville, have such a strong sense of identity as being from that community.
One other company that you compare or contrast, I'm not so sure which it is, to the GM situation is the Parker Pen Company. Well, I didn't even know that Parker Pens were originally manufactured in Janesville. And it was a very proud company. It was a company, a family-owned company. It didn't wind up that way, of course. But could you give us some example of the difference between a GM plant and a Parker company when it comes to investing in the community and being there for the people of a community?
Well, Janesville, for a city of about 63,000, has such a long, proud industrial past, and it really rested on these two pillars, General Motors, and then before General Motors, Parker Pen. The Parker Pen Company was started by a man named Parker in the late 19th century. He was a telegraphy instructor at a school training telegraph operators in Janesville. And training to be a telegraph operator, you needed to use a pen. And he found that a lot of the fountain pens that his students were using were leaking, so he resolved to build a better fountain pen, and he did, and that became the Parker Pen Company, which even by the start of the 20th century had international markets. So it was a company that was kind of doing globalization long before that became a prevalent way that U.S. manufacturers were doing business. And early in the 20th century, Parker Pen was really an example of what's called welfare capitalism, which meant that the managers of this company really took care of their workers, and the workers were very proud to be manufacturing these high-end fountain pens. And that kept going for a few generations of the Parker family and many generations of Janesville workers. And unlike the General Motors plant in town, which kept going under the General Motors ownership all the way until it shut down, Parker Pen eventually was sold and sold again and sold again, so that by the time it closed, the last vestiges of it in town closed down in 2010, it wasn't even making pens. It was making the lettering that are put on pens that were being made in other countries. So from this long, proud Parker Pen history, it had kind of an ignoble ending.
So how ingrained was GM factory in the daily life of the people of Janesville? I think I read at one point in your book where the radio station was actually synchronized with when employees got out of work.
That's right. Not everybody in town worked at one of these big iconic factories, but these factories really shaped the identity of the community. So as you say, the radio news was timed to the shift changes. People knew there were a lot of freight trains coming in and out of town, bringing in supplies and to some extent bringing away those vehicles that weren't being driven away in trucks. And everybody knew when to avoid the train tracks, given the rhythms of when the freight trains would come and go from Janesville. And grocery prices went up when people got raises at General Motors. So even if you didn't work at the company, you really felt its presence in a very daily, visceral way.
You're listening to Reader's Corner, and I'm talking with Amy Goldstein about her book, Janesville, An American Story. So what happens to thousands of people who are cast out of work? The first thing they think of is another job, but along with that comes the thought that they have to be prepared for that job. They have to be experienced. They have to be educated. And so that's where job retraining comes in. And you spend quite a bit of time in your book talking about this. I wonder if we could start with those who decided they'd go off to Black Hawk Junior College, Black Hawk Community College, I should say, and retrain. How'd that work?
Well, I was very interested in the question of if I was going to be looking at what happens when people lose work, the question then is, what do we as a society, as a government, recommend people do next? And job retraining is something that, unlike a lot of economic policies, both Democrats and Republicans in this country tend to think is a very good idea. So one of many reasons why I chose Janesville as a place to spend some years looking at was because it has a college, Black Hawk Technical College, that does a lot of vocational training. And after these layoffs happened in the next year or two, a couple thousand factory workers descended on this college. It was just the biggest increase in college enrollment anywhere in the state's technical college system in the system's century-long history. And the college tried very, very hard to help these people. People who worked at the college, instructors, administrators, discovered early on something that they hadn't expected, which is that some of these former factory workers who had been good at their old jobs weren't very skillful at using computers, didn't even know how to use Word to type, to write papers. So the college quickly started computer boot camps, created special seminars in how to study for people who maybe in their 30s and 40s and hadn't been a student for half their lifetime and might not have enjoyed school that much, which is why they found good factory work so appealing when they were getting out of high school decades ago. So the college was really trying very hard to make itself a hospitable place. And the other thing that people at the college were doing, which I thought was important, was they were working closely with people in the remaining business community to try to figure out where jobs were going to exist so that they could help recommend fields for which people could retrain. Well, that was all a good idea, but it was premised on something that turned out not to be the case, which was that jobs would come back after the Great Recession as quickly as they had from other recent recessions in this country's history. And jobs didn't come back so fast. So I got to know a lot of people who had retrained. And even if they finished their training program, which not everybody did, some people had a very hard time finding work afterwards.
And I believe you said that like only a third of the employees who went to Black Hawk to get an associate's degree or a technical degree, only a third of them made it.
That's right. I mean, that's true at many two-year colleges that not everybody who starts finishes. So it was about a third of the people who had gone to retrain after losing a job who finished either a degree or a certificate program.
One of the interesting things about this story is that President Obama comes to Janesville before the closing, of course, and paints a pretty rosy scenario of what the future looks like. Just briefly, I mean, I know our listeners remember what happened in 2008 and the GM bailout, but maybe you can help us understand why his predictions didn't ring so true.
Well, this was a very big speech that then-Senator Obama gave in February of 2008 when he was running for the Democratic nomination to become a presidential candidate. It was just before the Wisconsin primary, and he gave this very big economic speech right inside the Janesville assembly plant. And when I first started visiting Janesville, somebody suggested that I find a YouTube video of the speech, which I did back home. And I remember just having goosebumps when I listened the first time to the speech in which then-Senator Obama said, "The promise of Janesville is the promise of America." And he also said in that speech, he laid out his economic prescription as a candidate and said basically that if the country went along with his ideas for how to heal the economy, he said, this plant is going to be here for another 100 years. That was in February of 2008. Plant turned out its last Tahoe in December of that year.
Well, another story in your book that suggests politicians, even those running for president or even those who are currently the Speaker of the House, like Paul Ryan, don't often have much control over these issues. And tell us how Paul Ryan finds out that this plant in his district is closing.
Well, Paul Ryan has been Janesville's congressman since he was 28 years old. And at the time that the plant closing announcement happened in 2008, he was just a fairly young, ambitious congressman. He hadn't yet been a vice presidential candidate, and he certainly wasn't yet Speaker of the House. He wasn't even chairman of a House committee yet. But he, from his position in Congress, had probably the closest ties of any politician in the area to General Motors leadership at the time. And the night before the plant closing announcement was public, he was standing in his kitchen and gets a call on his cell phone from the then CEO of General Motors, giving him a heads up that announcement was going to be made the next morning. And I was fortunate to interview Congressman Ryan a few years ago, and he described this to me, that he just couldn't believe it. And he started yelling into the phone. I mean, he's not usually much of a yeller, but he was yelling into his phone that GM knew that it was going to ruin this plant and they should ruin this community, and they should pick a plant to close in a bigger community that wouldn't hurt the city so much. And he started ticking off the names of other more popular General Motors vehicles and said, well, if you don't want to make SUVs, GM Tahoes here anymore, then make one of these other plants here, but certainly don't close it down. After the plant closing announcement was public the next day, the state of Wisconsin, which had a Democratic governor at the time, and Congressman Ryan and a number of other leaders from both the United Auto Workers and kind of the political leadership, formed a task force very quickly to try to rescue this plant, to try to persuade General Motors to choose another product to be manufactured in Janesville. And a delegation went to Detroit a couple months after this closing announcement, late summer of 2008, and pleaded with General Motors' top brass to not close the plant. Paul Ryan was part of that delegation along with some Democrats, and it didn't work.
So now what's the timing of that happening and the bailout, the GM bailout?
Well, the plant closing was in June of 2008. I mean, the plant closing announcement was in June of 2008. The plant closed in December of that year. The General Motors bankruptcy was almost a year to the day after the plant had been announced to be closing, spring of 2009. In between those times, the George W. Bush administration and then the brand new Obama administration agreed to give a couple of automakers money to help them stay afloat. That money helped in the process. The CEO, who had called Paul Ryan that night, lost his job. But ultimately, it didn't save General Motors from declaring bankruptcy for a while. But the company climbed out of bankruptcy, so it had some positive effect in the long run.
When we were talking about the retraining just a bit ago, we were focused on the technical college. And I do want you to talk a little bit about Bob Bormans, who ran the Rock County Job Center. I got the impression from reading various sections of your book about his efforts that he was pretty frustrated over the fact that he really didn't think he got Congressman Paul Ryan in to help often enough. A lot of promises, but what can a congressman do? I guess that goes back to my point that these folks seem relatively as helpless as the workers when it comes to doing anything about this.
Well, in addition to following the lives of a few auto worker families over the several years after the plant closed, I also wanted to show the perspectives, the vantage points of several people in town who in different ways were trying to help people who had lost work. So I follow a social studies teacher who became very close and tried to help students she saw whose families were falling out of the middle class. I follow a banker who was the co-founder of a local kind of grassroots economic development organization that was created during this time. And Bob Borman, who you mentioned, was the head of the Rock County Job Center, which was kind of ground zero for where people showed up when they lost their work and weren't sure what to do. And the Job Center had a lot of counselors, gave people aptitude tests to try to figure out what line of work might suit them. And Bob really believed in job retraining. There was a lot of federal money available that was flowing all over the country, but there was a lot of it flowing into Janesville and the area surrounding Janesville. And Bob was one of the people who thought that if the laid-off factory workers just chose wisely and retrained in a field where work was likely to show up, then they would have jobs at the end. And he eventually came to understand correctly that this recession was very slow to lift from the country. So jobs weren't that available. He also had some sense that some of the federal rules that go along with the retraining money might have been better left to states and communities decide exactly how to spend that money. So Bob really poured his soul into trying to help these auto workers with, you know, mixed results.
I'm Bob Custer, a host of Reader's Corner, and my guest today is Washington Post reporter Amy Goldstein, talking about her book, Janesville. You know, we often don't equate plant closings with suicides, but you found one in your book. You found a number of cases where families were really left destitute, but I wonder if you could share with us certainly one of the most heart-wrenching stories in the book.
Well, I was interested from the start in the question of how different people fared after a job they thought was going to last their lifetime suddenly vanished. So I was interested in who did well and who didn't do well. And one of the women whose stories I tell in the book is a woman who worked at a seat manufacturing plant called Lear that was the biggest supplier to General Motors. And she and a Lear colleague went back to school. They retrained to go into criminal justice work. And they turned out to be terrific, enormously hardworking students who finished their programs and were very lucky to get these kind of coveted jobs at the county jail. But she makes some personal mistakes in her life and in the end takes a drug overdose. So it was a very sad end to what had looked at the outset like a pretty good recovery from job loss. Mm-hmm. And I was interested in her story because if you look at the research literature, there's a pattern in which all kinds of sort of social pathology tends to escalate when people lose work. That's not to say that everybody falls on hard times or turns to bad habits. But there are increases in addictions and there are increases in suicides. Rock County, which is the county for which Janesville, Wisconsin is the county seat, had an escalation in suicide for a few years after after all these good jobs went away. And this was one of them, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. By the way, what was Janesville's reaction? I guess I should say maybe public Janesville's reaction to your book. Did they feel like you didn't tell enough warm and cuddly stories about people that went on to lead great lives after this, or what?
Well, I have to admit that I was quite uncertain what the community's reaction to my book would be. I mean, Right. People had told me very personal stories, and the community as a whole, not that I got to know nearly everybody in town, but I got to know a fair number of people in town. They really had welcomed me over nearly 6 years, and I wasn't sure how the reaction would be. So a couple weeks after the book came out last spring, and then again this fall, I went back to Janesville to give a talk and then have kind of a community conversation at a big local church about the themes that the book raises. And I've got to say that the reaction was unexpectedly heartwarming. I think that many people, again, not everybody, but many people have told me they feel that I kind of dignified their experiences by writing close up about what happens when good work goes away. That happened to have been their work.
Well, you certainly did that. Let's talk about what happens to people when they do lose their job. And I'm not talking about going in for retraining, but the kind of folks you have to lean on for help, the not-for-profit sector. How was the not-for-profit sector in Janesville? I mean, they must have been, and you talk about this, you talk about the fundraising that everybody's trying to do, but they had to be besieged by people who were just looking for a way to get enough money for groceries next week.
Well, the nonprofits were besieged. Janesville, I didn't know this when I began visiting, but Janesville turns out to be a highly philanthropic community. So there were a lot of grassroots nonprofits that were really trying very hard. And I should say that one of the things that I've learned through this research to write this book is that losing work is an incredibly personal, psychologically hard experience for many people. Even when you're losing work at a time when thousands of people around you are losing the exact same kind of job, at a time when the country is going through the worst economic spell since the Great Depression of the 1930s, it still feels very personal. And people who've been middle class again, not to generalize, but many people who've been middle class find it very difficult to turn to anybody outside their own families for help. So the fact that people were turning to food pantry or Goodwill in town actually moved into bigger quarters because there were so many people who were shopping for clothes there, or a nonprofit free health clinic that I spent a lot of time at. These places were trying their mightiest to keep up with the demand, and it was hard to do.
You know, you followed a family, Jared Whitaker and his family. He had twin teenage daughters, and I was, I guess, as a university president who struggles all the time to wonder how our students can afford to get through without significant debt loads after college, I was really struck by the incredible focus these young kids had on part-time jobs and finding their way into college. But at the end of the day, it is not a good picture. I mean, they're clearly going to be indebted significantly. Again, the kind of stories that you just don't think about when you see a headline that some plant closed.
Well, I was interested in being able to show the perspective of people who are coming of age, because I figured that job losses didn't just affect the adult generation, but affected the sort of trajectory of people who were about to become adults. So the Whitaker family has twin daughters, and they're pretty remarkable kids. They were taking lots of AP classes. Their teachers really liked them. They were definitely college-bound. And between them, their senior year of high school, which is when I got to know them, they were working 5 part-time jobs, sometimes helping their family by slipping their parents' money to pay the bills or to pay groceries now and then. These girls were determined to go to college. They're finishing up college now. They're doing fine. But these are highly, highly motivated young women. And I don't think everybody in town is going to have as bright a trajectory as the Whitaker twins, though they're doing great themselves. I think also what's happened over time is that the Janesville school system, which is a pretty good school system, that even though this factory work had been available for decades and decades, had always pointed its students towards college. I think people in that school system in recent years have been rethinking whether they should be focusing more on vocational skills and what kind of work people can actually get in and near Janesville.
Well, the Atlantic Monthly has an article out, just came out last week, and it's an economist from George Mason University declaring that we're sending too many people to college with false promises that can't be kept, and vocational education is where the future is. And maybe that there's something to that as far as Janesville is concerned. So at the end of your book, you talk about two Janesvilles. Help us understand what Janesville looks like today in 2018.
Janesville had a tradition of being a pretty cohesive community. It's not that there weren't political differences. It's an old UAW town that leans Democratic, even though Paul Ryan has been its congressman for a long time. And like any community, it always had its differences among people of different beliefs, different faiths, different ideologies. But it had been a reasonably harmonious place. And like other parts of the country, there have been more class divides and more political divides as the years have gone on since the Great Recession. So I talk about two Janesvilles to mean that there are some people who were not personally touched by all this economic adversity. And some of them, you know, through no fault of their own, but just the way they've lived their lives, weren't even quite aware of the hardship that some of their neighbors were going through. And at the same time, there were a lot of people who, as we've been talking about, have fallen out of the middle class or fell down and been trying to climb back up. So I think that the class divide and the political divide has become more pronounced in this fairly small city as it has in the country.
Well, Amy, there's much more to read in your book, Janesville, An American Story. We've used up all our time here, but I want to encourage our listeners to get out and get a copy of this. There's a number of topics that I wish I would have had time to cover but didn't. Again, Janesville, An American Story by Amy Goldstein. Amy Goldstein, thanks so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
My pleasure.
Next week, Elizabeth Letts, author of The Perfect Horse, The Daring U.S. Mission to Rescue the Priceless Stallions Kidnapped by the Nazis. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Sherry Squires. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.